This is ground control to Major Tom. You've really made the grade. And the papers want to know whose shirts you wear. And I'm floating in a most peculiar way. And the stars look very different today.
Hello and welcome to Season 3, Episode 15 of Space Talks, a half-hour science-based show with an interest in all things space. I'm Stephen Lowry, along with co-host Tim Woods on Vancouver Island. And hello, Tim. Tell us of today's topic.
Well, Steve, today we're going to be talking about an exotic astronomical phenomenon called quasars. And in doing so, we're going to intersperse a little bit of fun along with the details. Because after all, Steve, we are not rocket scientists.
We're not even close. And today's topic of quasars is the first in a series about exotic stars and events, which include a menagerie of items such as magnetars, blazars, and something called Thorne-Zeigto objects, or TZOs.
You're making that stuff up, Steve. I mean, TZOs, that sounds a little sketchy to me. But why don't you tell us about your update?
Well, Tim, I'd like to start off referencing that classical mythical cowboy song entitled Ghost Riders in the Sky. And that's because there really and truly is a current operational lunar mission called Ghost Riders in the Sky.
Now, are you saying here that sometimes life imitates art?
Well, yes, it does. A Texas-based company called Firefly Aerospace, under contract with NASA, launched a lunar lander on January 15th with an intended moon landing this March 2nd. And to keep with the cowboy analogy, if you wish, the spacecraft itself is called Blue Ghost. Blue Ghost carries 10 NASA CLPS sensors. We've mentioned this before. CLPS is an acronym for Commercial Lunar Payload Services. And they're designed to conduct a variety of explorations ranging from perfecting laser calculations of the distance between the Earth and Moon to examining the electrostatic composition of the lunar regolith. It's intended that soon Firefly's Blue Ghost lander will conduct annual lunar missions with its CLPS sensors, which are customized for commercial venture.
I understand, Steve, that Blue Ghost destination is the Sea of Crises, or Mare Crisium for our Latin lovers. And it's about 560 kilometers from where Neil and Buzz landed back in 1969 in the Sea of Tranquility. Now, you know, Steve, I'd always been curious about the naming of that lunar landing spot, but I'd never really bothered to look it up. And at first, I confess, I thought perhaps NASA had named it itself as a way of keeping us optimistic about the astronauts' chances. You know, no worries, honey. We're going to a real nice spot that used to be a holiday destination for Martians, the Sea of Tranquility. Well, in true space talk tradition, I had to find out. The Sea of Tranquility got its name from Giovanni Battista Riccioli, an Italian astronomer back in 1651. Riccioli wanted to use some romantic and evocative names that he felt linked to the appearance of what seemed like ocean beds on the lunar surface.
And here's some more interesting facts about the Sea of Crises. It's the site of the unintentional crash landing of the Soviet Luna 15 probe on the very same day that Neil and Buzz walked on the moon. You see, the Russians were trying to steal some of the state's well-deserved thunder, but they failed. Although 9 years later in 1976, Luna 24 did successfully return to Earth with regolith samples from Mare Crisium. Not only that, Tim, here's a bonus for science fiction fans. Mare Crisium is the location for Arthur C. Clarke's 1948 seminal short story, The Sentinel, and that was later made into our favorite movie, 2001, A Space Odyssey.
Okay, I think we're done here, and we're at the stage where, wait a minute, is there more?
Oh yes, Ron Popeil is in the building. You got it in one. A mass concentration, or MASCON, of increased local gravity was identified in the center of Mare Crisium from Doppler tracking while NASA was mapping out possible landing sites for the imminent Apollo missions. And this localized extra gravity, which is hidden below the regolith, can slightly alter the paths of orbiting spacecraft. And additionally, Mare Crisium has weak magnetic anomalies, making it a truly scientifically interesting lunar region.
So before we leave this topic of mascons, we really have to mention that in Canada, there are several positive mascons with increased gravity. And the most prominent one is in the Sudbury Basin, and it was mentioned in our very first episode of Space Talks. There are other positive mascon sites, including the Manicouagan Crater and the Ungava Peninsula. They're both in Quebec. And interestingly, Hudson Bay has a negative gravity anomaly.
Well, Tim, how about your update for this week?
Well, not long ago, I had mentioned the election of Donald Trump might impact Canada's space program, and of course, in a bad way. Why would Trump want to see a Canadian astronaut on board the next NASA flight that's taking humans to the moon? And that seemed particularly problematic when I read that one of Elon Musk's buddies, a guy named Jared Isaacman, another billionaire, was said to become the new head of NASA. Well, not long after that, I saw another article on this by a guy named Michael Byers, who's a prof at UBC. And he's also the research chair in global politics and international law. So Byers had a catchy name for his article, which ran in the Globe and Mail. It was said to be Canada Lost in Space. Given the more recent events since that article was published in mid-January, I thought I'd cover off some of his analysis, which I think is pretty relevant today. Now, it's fair to say Canada has hooked a lot of its space ambitions to collaboration with the United States in general and NASA in particular. Steve, we've mentioned more than once that Canadian astronaut Jeremy Hansen was named to be one of four astronauts going on that first return flight to the moon, which has been delayed now till 2026. Well, how did we ever get that slot on that critical mission? It was, in fact, a negotiation for Canadian money spent building a new space robotic arm for a lunar research station. Okay, move forward. Elon Musk's friend and the future NASA head that I just mentioned, Isaacman, is very much on the same page about going to Mars versus going to the moon. And the costs of going to the moon keep rising for NASA as its approach reflects the cautious NASA traditions and not that hell-bent for fury strategy of SpaceX. There's considerable expectation that NASA might in fact, the new NASA that is, cancel the lunar research station, leaving Canada's investment in the robotic arm lost in space. And there's also speculation that the oft-delayed SLS system that would have Jeremy Hansen get to the moon, well, that could be dropped too, in favor of, you guessed it, a SpaceX flight for its own Starship. So I'm not sure, Steve, but I wouldn't think it very likely that either Trump or Musk are going to honor any deal, any arrangement or negotiation with anyone, Canada included.
Well, thanks for that update, Tim, bleak as it may be. Well, as advertised, our main topic today is quasars, a word which, at least in me, invokes images of the mysterious, so much so that I decided to test its impact on some willing participants.
Willing participants? You mean like man on the street interviews?
It would be more correct to say it was a customers and staff in a downtown Salmon Arm coffee shop interview, Tim. I gently asked a few people if they knew what a quasar was, and if not, what image did the sound of that name invoke? Not surprisingly, only one person knew what a quasar was, and she was the owner of the establishment. Others made valiant guesses as to what a quasar might mean, with answers ranging from a flower, something in the desert, to a Mexican fried food. You know, Tim, I think he was thinking of a quesadilla. Interestingly, one person said, after some thought, I'm not sure, but it's a descriptive word. And you know what? She was partially right. Personally, back in 1967 was when I first heard the word quasar, and it had nothing to do with astronomy. In that year, quasar was established as a television brand by Motorola, which emphasized the simplified design of their all-solid-state and transistor-equipped television sets. Now, youthful listeners likely don't know the significance of this, but in the early days of television, a TV might use as many as 40 vacuum tubes used to control volume, signal gain, brightness, horizontal hold, and so on. And when your TV went on the fritz, as it often did, it took ages for a technician to discharge latent voltage, remove the tubes one at a time, and test them in a portable device to isolate the faulty unit. The new Quasar TV chassis eliminated vacuum tubes and was designed in such a way that the electronic components slid out as a unit from a drawer and was completely replaced in seconds.
You know, that's sort of a modular approach, and it's used now for fixing cars and I guess many other things. Let's say on your car, your alternator starts to act up, and in my case, it did. Rather than open up the alternator to find the problem, at the first hint of it being the alternator, it gets yanked and they swap in a new one $1,500 later. So getting back to the Quasar TV, I believe the faulty modules were returned to the Motorola company. They refurbished them and offered them as discounted options to customers. And by the way, that's exactly what happened at my car dealership. They suggested I could buy a slightly cheaper refurbished alternator plus the change.
Ooh, how continental. Well, I've managed to find a 1974 Quasar TV ad, and with a discerning ear, you'll be feasted with not only its technological solid-state advances, but its parallel to space research, augmented with a spacey musical ending and a fetching female voice urging the consumer, of course it's the 50s and 60s, it's a man, with "Reach out to Quasar." And the advertisement ends with an authoritative and dramatic quota of notes. I think it's quite effective, but do have a listen and you be the judge.
By reaching out to see things differently, man's genius is now helping to free him from his earthly home. Another result of that reaching out, the amazing electronic devices like this one, designed for Quasar Color TV. It's part of our continuing improvement in 100% solid state design, where solid state devices contribute to your confidence in the set you buy.
Reach out for Quasar!
My first astronomical introduction to the word Quasar wasn't until a couple of years later, 1971, while I was taking an introductory university course in astrophysics. Now, it would be more than fair to say that at this time, I was far more interested in casually reading aircraft magazines such as RAF Flying Review than I was in scanning through Sky and Telescope or Sky News. How about you, Tim? Do you recall first hearing about quasars?
Absolutely, Steve. My doctor removed one of those things from my elbow. Well, you know, I thought about this and I can't remember the first time I heard about those. But in regard to the actual discovery of quasars, I did some research. And that says that it was in the 1950s that a number of radio astronomical surveys revealed bright radio sources emanating from space, but their exact nature, not clear. So it was in 1960 that a fellow named Alan Sandage and his colleague Thomas Matthews discovered a peculiar star-like object associated with a strong radio source listed as 3C48. Now, to clarify, they noticed a faint glow in the optical part of the spectrum coming from that bright radio source, but they couldn't figure out if there was a correlation between the two observations. 3C48 might sound like the name of a Star Wars robot. In this case, it's a listing number used by the office staff at the Cambridge Radio Telescope, and that's what the C stands for.
3 years later, 1963, the Dutch-born astronomer Dr. Martin Schmidt was analyzing the spectrum of another such object, this one called 3C273, and he made a breakthrough discovery when analyzing its visible spectrum. He realized that its emission lines were highly redshifted, meaning it was 2.7 billion years from Earth, far beyond our Milky Way galaxy. Further, considering this immense distance, 3C273 had to be incredibly luminous. This one source was brighter than an entire galaxy. And at first, this and other similar objects were called quasi-stellar radio sources, because though they were as bright or brighter than stars, they didn't exhibit the entire array of stellar properties.
So, remaining with the history, quasi-stellar radio sources were the central theme of an international symposium on astrophysics held in Dallas in December of 1963. And there, Taiwanese-born Dr. Hong Li Chu coined the term quasar, which was first published in the May 64 edition of Physics Today.
Boy, we do our research, don't we? And later it was discovered that not all quasars were strong radio sources. Those without significant radio emissions were called something very similar sounding. They were called quasi-stellar objects, or QSOs. So we have two similar sounding stellar entities, quasi-stellar radio sources, quasars, and quasi-stellar objects, QSOs.
But for the purposes here, a rose by any other name would smell as sweet. So at this point, astronomers were still puzzled as to what mechanism in a quasar could generate this tremendous observed energies. Before we get into quasars again, let's recap how quasars created such an astrophysical quandary. It was in the 1950s that radio astronomy was detecting sources of bright energy. And then in the 60s, visible light was becoming associated with these radio sources. So analysis of this visible light then proved it to be coming from an extremely distant source, well beyond our Milky Way galaxy. To be so far away and yet visible, well, that meant it must be extremely powerful. And the hunt was then on to figure out how this could be.
Now, some astronomers thought that the problem was so great that quasars couldn't possibly be as far away as they were. So perhaps quasars represented new physics. Another suggestion made by Edward Teller, father of the hydrogen bomb, was that quasar energies were due to the collision of huge clouds containing perhaps 10 million solar masses of matter and antimatter. But there was zero evidence of large amounts of antimatter. Scratch that idea. Nuclear fusion also seemed an unlikely source, even though that is what powers stars, because it's impossible to pack 100 billion suns into a region only 1 light-year across in diameter.
And finally, an increasing number of astrophysicists began to focus on the concept of a black hole created by the implosion of a massive star to somehow being the source of this energy. And it was in 1964, doctors Edwin Salpeter and Yakov Zeldovich independently proposed that a stream of gas falling toward a black hole could in fact generate these high-powered X-rays.
The confirmation of this idea came in 1971, when combined X-ray, optical, and radio observations led to the conclusion that an X-ray source in the constellation Cygnus, which was called Cygnus X1, was due to a black hole of about 10 solar masses feeding upon its companion star. And we should note here, Tim, that most stars are not solitary entities. They exist as binary twins. And secondly, the apparently banal zoological phrase of feeding off is the actual term used in astrophysics.
That's a little odd itself, isn't it? So this discovery opened the way for the eventual acceptance of a black hole model as the central powerhouse of quasars. And doctors Donald Lindenbell and Martin Rees of Cambridge University in England showed that a gigantic black hole in the center of a galaxy could produce the necessary energy if it swallowed matter or gas in an amount equal to about one sun per year.
And it's here that we should refer to a bit of elementary logic using the sentence, all dogs are animals, but not all animals are dogs.
Ah, so following that, all quasars are black holes, but not all black holes are quasars.
Exactly so, Tim. And that leads us to the slight differentiation between two terms previously mentioned, namely quasars and QSOs. Quasars are active supermassive black holes, while QSOs are somewhat similar, but quiet and rather inactive and aren't of interest here.
So we should note it wasn't our intent to go into what black holes are or how stars become black holes in this episode. Rather counterintuitively, we wanted to talk about these supermassive black holes, quasars, without doing a spoiler alert, but we're going to dedicate an entire episode to black holes in the future.
Gravity at the center of a black hole is infinite, and everything which comes within its grasp is consumed, but not eaten by a cavernous, monstrous maw in one great chomp, as I confess to imagining for years.
Instead, attracted objects don't fall directly into the black hole following a straight line. They take a different path, The best visual analogy I can think of is the water in your bathroom sink circling the drain before it goes down the center. And in space, it's not water circling this black hole, it's gas and dust, with the gas being stripped away from a companion star, as mentioned earlier, and the dust coming from remnants of supernovas and other interstellar material.
And due to something called the conservation of angular momentum, the swirling gas is not globular in shape, but flattened into a disk, which spins faster and faster as it nears the center of the black hole. And this shape becomes known as the accretion disk.
Hey, Steve, I've got another analogy for you. It seems to me that there's a fairly good reference point most of us have right at home for this, and I'm talking about dust bunnies. There they are, lying in small pancake-like formation, just waiting to be sucked into the black hole that I call a vacuum cleaner. Now, a black hole spinning disk creates no noise because there's no medium. The spinning gas and dust do emit prodigious amounts of energy in the form of long-wave radio, optical, X-ray, and down to shortwave gamma radiation.
To give some idea of the energy which must be released, let's examine the speed of the swirling accretion disk at three different distances from the center of the black hole. The outer disk of gas and dust is swirling around at about 1,000 kilometers per hour. Now, that sounds pretty fast to me, Tim, but things really speed up going inward, don't they?
They sure do. Near the point of no return, which is called the event horizon, the gas is swirling at about 50% of the speed of light, and that equates to 540 million kilometers per hour. And if that wasn't enough, just before crossing the event horizon, the swirling gas reaches 95% of the speed of light, which is, if you can believe it, over 1 billion kilometers per hour. And it's hard to imagine the energy that would be going on at that speed.
Tim, we've given our listeners a lot to ponder today, and as always, we hope that Space Talk sparks interest into pursuing personal research. But before we go, here are some absolutely fascinating facts to perhaps act as those starting points. Virtually all galaxies have quasars in their center. However, the black hole in the center of our Milky Way, which is called Sagittarius A star, is actually starving, since it's only consuming the equivalent mass of a few moons each day, even though it itself has a mass of 886 million suns. We have a black hole at our center, but it's not a quasar. And a little personal research will reveal why that's the case.
The closest galaxy to us, which does contain a quasar, is Markarian 231, and it's located 581 million light years away in the constellation Ursa Major. And yes, before you ask, Markarian is named after the person who cataloged it. And in this case, an Armenian astrophysicist, Benjamin Markarian. This quasar contains about 125 million solar masses.
And speaking of analogies and sizes in terms of solar masses, let's go ringside for some heavyweight matches with our own Tim Woods doing the color commentary. He's going to be starting off with some of tonight's contenders listed in the Sloan Digital Sky Survey, and as such, their names all start with SDSS. Over to you, Tim.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. For our first match in the red corner, we have up and coming J010013, tipping the scales at a svelte 12 billion solar masses. And his opponent in the blue corner, from the same catalog, is J140821, doubling up at 24 billion solar masses. That should be a good one, folks. Following that, round two will feature the well-known quasar from the High Energy Catalog, going in by the name of H1821, and with both feet evenly on the scales, coming in at a ponderous 30 billion solar masses. Well, he'll need this, as his opponent from the Sloan catalog is J21572, who shatters the scales with 34 billion solar masses. These quasars are going to put on quite the show.
Just a minute, Tim. Just a minute. There's a commotion in the wings. Something truly massive appears to be... It's tilting the floor and dimming the lights. Can it be? We were hoping for such a surprise cameo appearance, but... We're afraid to make mention for fear of disappointment. Tim, I can't see clearly. Can you confirm that it's none other than the king of them all? He who must be obeyed.
Ladies and gentlemen.
Oh, the humanity.
Oh, the humanity. It is the superhero from the Tone and Zintla catalog from Mexico. Yes, Tone, 618, himself in the building.
Just look at him, Tim. All 66 billion solar masses of pure quasar. Unchallenged and unafraid. And he's here on Space Talks. Words fail me at this point, Tim. I'm going to leave it up to you to sign us off.
Well, we hope you've gained some insight into what quasars are in this last half an hour of Space Talks, because we surely have. And until next time, this is Tim Woods.
And Stephen Lowry from the outskirts of Sagittarius A star saying so long, and we'll see you next time on
Space Talks.
Hey, Mr. Spaceman, won't you please take me along for a ride?